AM Planta on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Raincoast Chronicles 24 has just been released by Harbor Publishing. Its author Judith Williams joins me now to discuss Cougar Companions, Butte Inlet Country, and the legendary Schnars. She does a wonderful job illuminating what life was like in Butte Inlet at the turn of the century. She talks about what motivated settlers, prospectors, trappers, and loggers to come to British Columbia, especially in this remote part of the coast. She follows the lives of the Schnarr family, especially the life of August Schnarr, who would make his living off the land, but would also take photographs. He would strap a Kodak camera to his suspenders, and he climbed mountains, and his collection of photos is a remarkable diary of 50 years of life up coast. August took photos of his three daughters and their pet cougars, and through Judith's research, she sought first-hand accounts, archival material, and done her own research, providing a full view of the Schnarrs, the people around Butte Inlet, and these marvelous photos. Judith Williams is an assistant professor emeritus at the University of British Columbia. Her previous books include Clam Gardens and Dynamite Stories. She joined me from her home on Cortez Island, British Columbia. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Judith Williams. Professor Williams, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. As I was telling you just before we started, just how fascinating this book is, and I mean, there's so much that I want to ask you about it. But I want to start with the place, Butte Inlet. Where is that for people listening to us? If you could place it sort of on a map, if you will.
Okay. Well, a lot of your people who will be listening will be in the Lower Mainland, and it's a good 100 miles from Vancouver to Desolation Sound, which is a kind of the beginning of the area itself. And so the inlet is a good 80 kilometers from where I am right now, which is on Cortez Island, mm-hmm. sort of facing out into the Desolation Sound area. And it's what's called the mid-coast, generally.
Right.
It's one of the series of inlets, like a set of fingers, actually, that kind of jam themselves into the coast of British Columbia. And they're incredibly long and often complicated inlets, and with very different weather from the area on the coast, say on the islands off the coast.
Right.
And they're kind of a bit unknown, some of them, because boating to them is difficult. And, of course, there's certainly no roads to them.
So boating is the only way to get to them, right? To get to the inlet, right?
Yes. Well, there is a small landing strip at Hamafco Camp, which is one of the logging camps that remain up there. And you can fly in.
Yeah. And so August Schnarr is such a fascinating figure. When was it that he ended up there?
Well, it looks to me that he was there as early as 1910. Back there in about 1913, but it looks like he and his brothers kind of fished their way down the coast after they'd been logging at Port Hardy on Vancouver Island, mm-hmm. the top of Vancouver Island, and they were exploring and hunting and fishing as they went because they had to support themselves, and they did end up in Butte, and they went up the Southgate River, which is the river that there's two rivers at the top, two main ones. And they went up the Southgate, and they built a couple of cabins and spent some time there.
And so I understand he was born in Centralia. That's in Washington State, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It looked like the family immigrated there. They were German-Americans, and they moved there. There would be a lot of land available, and they cleared an homestead there.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of other than making a living, why he chose this place to go?
Well, he says in tapes, he made a number of tapes were made with August Schnarr in the 70s mm-hmm. at the Campbell River Museum, and he does say that he wanted to get involved in trapping animals down where he lived, but there just wasn't much to get.
Right.
And he heard about British Columbia, and he came up to Vancouver in 1909, and then he came back and went up to Port Hardy logging. I guess he realized he could get a job during the season, and then when they shut down logging and shut down the mills and things like that, he could go exploring, and so then he started looking for land and places to live, because he seemed determined to live up here.
Yeah. And
he was interested in the wilderness, and right. He was interested in animals.
Yeah. And so photography, I guess, was not something. I mean, we're all photographers now because of our phones and the sort. But in that time, at the turn of the century, or just after the turn of the century, I guess a lot of people didn't have cameras, right? And so what was he a photographer? How did he come to, say, own that camera, the Kodak camera that he had?
It's a bit of a mystery, actually, because the camera looks like it was made in 1910.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he had it all his life. There's pictures of him, the picture of him up in Night Inlet with it. It's very early. Why he decided to do it is interesting. Photography, people don't think this way anymore, but it was a kind of upper class activity, early mm-hmm. photography. It wasn't something that was common, and it wasn't cheap. And so the fact that he extended himself into the camera, my thought is that he may have very well bought the camera in Vancouver, Spencer's department store, which some older people will remember,
yeah.
Had a photography department very early there, as soon as they had the store. And Eaton's and Woodward's also had photographic departments. So he may have been exposed to the fact that you could get a camera. But what motivated him, I think he was essentially a person who wanted to document what he was doing.
Yeah.
And he saw that the landscape was spectacular. And he then undertook taking all these photographs. I think he may have also photographed animals,
uh-huh.
both dead and alive, because he was wanting to sell furs.
Mm.
And it's possible that he sent some of these photographs to the people that he wanted to provide with furs. So that was Pappas Furs in Vancouver, which still exists,
right.
And also the Hudson's Bay Company. He dealt with both of these people.
And so that's largely how he made his living in those years, right?
He made his living by trapping
mm-hmm.
in the winter when the pelts are good. And he also hand-logged, which was a kind of early simple way to log, although you had to be very clever and very strong, particularly clever. And he also fished a bit as well. So he did what he could to earn a living.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was just thinking, this camera that we see a picture of in the book, how big is that?
It's about 10 inches long and about 4.5, 5 wide and about almost 2 inches thick in the carrying case. The camera mm-hmm. then slides out, and it's, you know, something that fits snugly in that carrying case. And then it's a bellows camera, so you click it open and you extend the bellows and you have actually a fair-sized camera.
Yeah.
And it took a decent-sized negative, which is one of the reasons I was able to get decent photographs, because the negatives still exist.
Right. And so you've seen this camera.
Yes, I have it right here. Yeah.
Yeah. How heavy is it?
It's about 4 pounds.
Yeah. So if he was going in the bush and things like that, it was not something cumbersome for him to carry around, right?
Oh, he had this habit of hooking the carrying case on his suspenders.
Mm.
So they were kind of tucked close to his body. And so when he's moving through the bush, and the camera case is quite smooth and rounded, and it's brown leather, and it's not too bulky. I can see he could cart it around with him.
And so, what would he do with the negatives? Say, would he wouldn't process them himself? Would he?
It doesn't seem like. The reason I think not is I found a couple of little envelopes in the Camel River Museum archives,
uh-huh.
And one is from Spencer's department store.
I see.
So I know of its existence, and I knew they had a camera department. There's also some from a long rope from Woodward's, and so it looks to me as if the film was sent south on the steamer. The steamer ran every week
mm-hmm.
from Vancouver up into these areas. People who are my age don't know this, but sometimes it was easier to move around then than it is right now.
Right.
And the steamer would be carting stuff back and forth of various kinds. So the family ordered food and clothing and various goods from Woodward's and other companies down there, and then it would come on the freighter. So I think sending the film down, back down, and then getting the prints back would probably have been done that way.
Yeah. It's remarkable to think how much was done by rail. And as you just said, how much easier then to see this province than it is now.
Well, I'm old enough to have rode the steamers with my mother when I was a small child, because we used to come from Vancouver or Victoria to Texada Island. Mm. And the boat stopped all over, particularly at Powell River. They rolled newsprint onto the boats from there. It was the way the newsprint got back down to Vancouver.
Yeah.
And everywhere. And so the boats just stopped everywhere, and freight was hauled on and off and lifted off with big winches and deposited on the docks, and then you had to find a way to get it to where you wanted.
Yeah.
But certainly the Schnars, it's recorded them going down to Stewart Island to meet the steamer.
Right. Now, how big was the family up there? There was August, and he was married. He had three daughters, is that correct?
Yes. So August married Zeta,
mm-hmm.
Lancel. There's still lots of Lancels around. And she was a family that had homesteaded up in Thurston Bay. And he was in the area logging and working in a machine shop. He did a lot of things, to earn a living. And they got married, and she had a baby daughter, which was the daughter Pansy,
mm-hmm.
when they got married. And then they very, very quickly had Pearl. And then they moved away from that area around Shoal Bay and moved up into Butte. And then they had the third daughter, Marion. And then that's all the children they had. And then Zeta herself died very, very early, in the early 30s.
Yeah.
And so August was left with the three girls to raise.
And he had help, though, in terms of raising them, right?
He briefly had help. There was an aunt, Flossie, who I suspect was a Lancel, and she didn't last long. And then a Mrs. Godkin came, and she also didn't last long. The girls were a handful, and the life was a handful.
Mm, right.
Most women didn't want anything to do with it.
Yeah. What was a typical day like for them, Judith?
I'm not so sure when the girls were little, but there's one record by another woman who I knew much, much later of the girls coming to visit her when she was a young girl. And her mother was a cook at a logging camp up in Butte. And so she, in her reminiscences, talks about the whole family coming to visit, complete with cougars. And that's about the only record I have of that kind of activity from another child.
Uh-huh. Right?
And I happened to know that child much later in her life, and so I trust this report. And then the biggest detail we have is Marion's record in the Cougar Companions albums that my book is based on, when she writes about the father bringing home the baby cougars. And so then she kind of, you get a sense of the life there and how they're living. They were living at Owen Bay at that point, and the girls were going to school there.
Yeah.
And then later there's another, quite a lot of information from Pansy, when she writes in 1938-39 about them building a new boat at Owen Bay, new cabin, and then moving everything back up to Butte. So there's quite a lot of detail there of the daily life.
You mentioned these albums, Cougar Companions. There were three of them, right?
There were at least three. There might have been four. There's some confusion on the part of the family about this. But Pearl Schnorr had one.
Uh-huh.
August seems to have had one, too. There's one signed as belonging to him in the Camel River Museum. And certainly the Pansy had one. And whether Marion herself had one and that family still has it, I cannot tell you.
Yeah.
So there could have been four.
Right. And so how big were these albums?
Oh, they're about 14, usual album size. as if you put your photographs in an album. And she obviously got a set of albums, and then she each one is a slight variant on the other.
And
that is one thing that everybody agrees on.
Yeah, and so you got your hands on one of them, is that right? How long ago was that?
There was a woman here on the island. She realized I was doing research about Beauty Inlet for an exhibition at the Small Museum on Cortez, and she said, I'll lend you this because there's a lot of interesting information about this family.
Uh-huh.
And she did lend it to me. I thought it came from Glenn Fair.
Mm-hmm.
She just said it had belonged to Glenn. But then it turned out it belonged to Pearl Macklin, and her son was very unhappy that this had wandered.
His name was Glenn, too, right?
Yeah, there's two Glenns, right? And then it was because of his demanding it back, quite rightly, really. I mean, it wasn't outrageous. He brought me to give it back to her, his mother.
Yeah, and she was quite old at the time, right?
Yeah, she was about 83 then, and not well.
Uh-huh.
She'd had a complicated life. All the girls did, actually. The girls had complicated lives as adults, as teenagers and as adults.
Yeah.
And Pearl had a complicated life. She had her first husband drowned right in front of her and her son. And then she married again, and then it looks like she was divorced, but then she married again.
And so when you brought the album to Pearl, she was able to walk you through the photographs and tell you, I guess, sort of the background as to each of them. Is that right?
We went right through the album, page by page, and she certainly talked about every photograph. And then she also had her own family album,
mm-hmm.
which she wanted to go through. And then she had a third album, which had been given to August by the Mondays, who are famous mountaineers, because he helped them. And so there was a small album that had been gifted back to him from them.
So you obviously were able to get, say, first-hand accounts, and then you mentioned a moment ago all these other reports that you got from people that knew this family in the past. You also do an incredible amount of research in terms of writing this book. And so what does that tell you about people and their memories? Because, I mean, you really have to do the due diligence in terms of checking everything out that someone will tell you, right?
Well, I do say that memory is theater. I'm quoting somebody far more famous than I am. But I think that if you think of somebody like Pearl going through this stuff with me, it's like it is theater in which she is starring.
Mm.
Although she was a very modest woman, and so I don't mean to imply that she only talked about herself. That
sure.
wasn't true.
Sure.
But she is telling me what she remembers. The albums themselves are the memories of Marion Parker, Marion Schnarr Parker. She put them together, but she varied each one a little bit depending on who it was made for.
Mm.
So there's a little bit of, there's not much, but it's a slight variant in the photographs that are chosen and the way things are displayed. So she's thinking also of the sister or her father who's going to look at them. And then I've done a lot of other historical research. This is the fifth book. And I don't say that I am approach things in a scholarly way. I am a visual artist as well, and I view the works as artworks. And so I try to bring in the voices of other people and let them speak if I can. If I can find something that where they taped or that they've written, or like Pansy's case, she wrote this diary.
Uh-huh.
I like to let them speak. And in the book, I have that opportunity. There's two diaries there that are used, one by Charlie Rasmussen, which is a wonderful thing,
mm-hmm.
and then Pansy's, and then these people were taped. Then, of course, you're looking at people who knew them and what they have to say. The Schnarrs were extremely well known. He was a kind of a famous character in the neighborhood, and so when I've been giving talks about the book, Camel River Museum, the Courtney Museum, Powell River, Vancouver Maritime Museum, people turn up who knew these people.
Mm.
And they bring pictures, and they bring more stories. And sometimes, you know, you get this stuff cross-referenced, and you think, well, yeah, I think I've got the whole story here about that incident.
Yeah.
Right? But sometimes you're dealing with an 85-year-old man who's telling you a story about trying to visit the girls when he was 16 up in Butte and being terrified at the cougars who came down to the dock.
Yeah.
You know, so, but he's 85, right? So
right.
And he wants to tell you this story. And then somebody told me a story that was very similar about her father. And I think, oh, these two young guys, they're up there logging in their late teens, and they want to go visit the girls, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the cougars are front and center, and they're terrifying, right?
Yeah.
They're on the loose.
Well, was it, in terms of them raising the cougars, I mean, the story is that, I guess, August had shot the mother, and then I didn't know this because I've never had pets, but I guess felines or cougars, like cats, they're born blind, so the first thing they see, I guess, is who they cling to, and in this case, in terms of the cougars, it was the three sisters, right? The three daughters.
Yes, and Mrs. Godkin as well.
Yeah.
So we know a lot about imprinting in animals,
uh-huh.
and that they imprint on the first thing they see. And since these kittens never saw their mother,
yeah.
although they had been with her and were nursed by her, the next thing they saw were the people who were feeding them and
yeah.
cleaning them, and they were female.
Yeah.
And then Mrs. Godkin left uh-huh. quite quickly, so the people who they looked after them as baby cougars, were these girls.
And so the relationship, obviously, between the girls and the cougars was quite close. There are no stories in terms of say, one of the cougars getting out of line or something like that or being harmful to them, right?
There's nothing to say that they ever offered any aggression towards the girls. The girls were present when the cougars would snarl at somebody else.
Yeah.
And they were pretty careful about leashing them when anybody else was around. So in all the photographs where somebody's taking a picture who isn't one of the family,
yeah.
you can tell that they've got their collars on and they've got their chains on. And I think they were pretty scrupulous about that. But when they were up in Butte, the cougars wandered.
Mm.
And they wandered on the boats. They were never chained up on the boats. And people do report having seen the boat go by with the cougars sort of on the deck. And but when they were at Owen Bay, they did have to chain them because they tended to follow the girls to school.
Yeah.
And then they liked to jump out and surprise them. Well, it was all right with the girls, but it wasn't all right. Somebody else was surprised
right.
by a cougar who's being playful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, you don't even know if it's playful at that point, right?
Well, you wouldn't have any idea.
Yeah.
One man that told me about going to try and visit the girls, he got his boat tied up. This is at Schnarr's Landing, way uh-huh. up in Butte. He said, I got the boat all tied up. And, of course, he was thinking about that. He said, I turned around, and two cougars started to walk down the ramp. He said, I just got back to the boat and left. He said, he said, I didn't know what to do.
Right. Right.
Yeah, you know, he's only 16, he said. And he, because the logging camps were quite close across the channels and whatnot, and everybody talked about these good-looking girls up in there.
Yeah, yeah. The story of August, I'm curious, you know, you mentioned listening to tapes at the Campbell River Museum there. These were done, I guess, late in his life. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And what did he sound like?
Well, he... I've tried to read how he sounds when I've been doing these presentations. When he's talking about his childhood, he says, you worked from the time you was able.
Mm.
And I can hear that. Right,
yeah,
but you can listen to the tapes, and he's a folky guy, you know.
Yeah,
he's a talker. He's certainly not afraid to keep talking, but I got that from some other people who met him that he had, you know, he often had quite a bit to say.
Uh-huh.
So he wasn't shy or anything, and he spoke out clearly, and he was quite opinionated about game laws and things like that were, you know, which impacted him, like the rules of what he could do.
Yeah.
He was very outspoken about that, and then he liked to talk about his boat and his propeller and all this kind of stuff and logging. A particularly good report from Dane Campbell, who I know quite well, who was an up-coast guy, and he visited him at a certain point. And Dane reports quite well on how he, what his manner was like. And then the grandsons, they also speak about him, and they have quite a differing opinions about how they found him quite gruff and critical, you know, as kids. Like, they were, you know, he was putting them in their place. And certainly Pansy reports him being real tough with the girls about what they had to do.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when he left them up in Butte for the summers, when they were really quite young, they had a quota of jam they had to produce, and it had to be done by the time he got back. So I think he was pretty demanding.
Mm-hmm.
Marion said one thing to me on the phone, which I think is telling. She said, "My father was an exceptional man. He didn't always realize that others weren't."
Mm-hmm.
And she's a pretty cool head about this. She spent, you know, a longer time with them as a teenager, and I think she's a good character study.
Yeah. What was the interaction with the indigenous population in and around Butte Inlet? Was that something that they did regularly? And in terms of numbers, can you give us a sense of how many people were around there at the time?
I can't exactly, but there were people living in the inlet from the beginning of the Schnorrs being up there.
Uh-huh.
So if August and then his brothers were there, you know, in the years between 1910 and 1913, 14, and they were, you know, from reports from his brother Johnny Schnorr and Marion's book about Johnny, there would have been a fair number of people in various places seasonally. One thing I do know about the Homolka is they moved to specific sites for food gathering. So they speak in terms of Bear Bay and Bear River. That's a source for X fish, and then the South Gate is a place where they had fish traps,
mm-hmm.
And they had three different kinds, and so they're trapping salmon that are coming up. And the Taquahon, there were different kind of fish in there. And then at the Orford River, where there was a village site, there would be other fish running up that particular, which is a good salmon river. And so the Schnorrs were interacting with them, and one of the reasons they were interacting is they used to trade jam, which they made,
mm-hmm.
for fish. They needed a lot of fish to feed themselves and also to feed the cougars, because
right.
that's the main backbone. So they had to trade for more fish than they themselves could catch. And so that would be interaction with the First Nations who were fishing up there and with fishermen, some of whom would be First Nations or something like that.
Yeah.
And then Pansy speaks about the baskets that they bought and her mother bought, which implies that Zeta, when she was alive, traded for baskets with the First Nations up there. But how many people lived there and where they lived is a little complicated because they're moving seasonally to the fishing areas. So they're moving into swift water in the mouth of Temasco. There's a coho spawning area in Cumsack Creek,
uh-huh.
and there's the Indian Reserve right there, where the spawning area is, and so they're kind of shifting around. But there is a graveyard at Potato Point at the mouth of the Homolka River up at the end of Butte, and how late that was used, I do not know. There's nothing that you can find anymore, but. It would have been used, I would think, well into the 20s and 30s.
Right. As I'm finishing the book, I'm wondering what that's one of the things I've been looking forward to in terms of reading the book and then talking to you about it, is what are your thoughts on the motivation to document their lives the way they did, especially August in terms of getting a camera at 1910 and and wanting to take pictures of what he saw, what he did. Do you think, and then in terms of say capturing all of this and then putting them in these albums that they kept for themselves, did they have a sense of who would see this later on? I mean, I know that might be perhaps a lofty goal for somebody to think that history might be interested in this stuff. But did August in particular, did he have that on mind maybe as he was taking these pictures?
There's nothing that is, I can put my finger and say, this specific thing tells me about that. I just have to look at the photographs themselves that he starts taking very early. And so many of them have to do with process of living in this environment. And the other thing I'd say that he was mad for the wilderness. And mad for history. I mean, he makes a point of documenting anything he can find to do with Waddington's road building from the 1860s. He goes up in those territories and he makes an effort to find evidence of all of that. And what he knew about that, I'm not sure. One thing that's unusual about what happened in the 1860s, and the first book I wrote, which is High Slack, is about Waddington's Road and what happened there with the Chilcotin people and the other natives up there. There was an odd artist named Whymper, Frederick Whymper, who was up there just before the disasters, murders there. And all that material was turned into visual and textual material by Whymper, and it was published in illustrated newspapers papers in London.
Mm-hmm.
And also that material would have wandered back to Victoria and was well covered also in the Daily Colonist newspaper. Mm-hmm. There. Whether August read this stuff, I cannot tell you. There's no record of any of that material in the files.
Mm-hmm.
But he certainly knew this historical event, and he made an effort to follow up on it and take photographs of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he clearly had educated himself somehow. He had almost no education, but somehow he learned to read and write because he took an engineering course later in his life,
mm-hmm.
and he got 100% on it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his grandsons said, "I thought, Glenn Fair, I'd take that course." And he said, "You know, I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
It was too hard." So somehow he's educated himself, despite having no schooling to speak of, and he's developed intellectual interests of those kinds. And then he's taken it into the documentary of his life and the animals that he hunts and the people around him, because he photographs his pals.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people he takes up the river with him, and people who go hunting with him, people who run local logging camps, takes pictures of them all.
The other thing I was thinking about as I was reading the book is how we capture our lives today, and how, I don't know, 100 years from now, do you think a historian like yourself will find enough material to piece together a life or a family's life and what they did? Because it's a different time. Do you think there will be this sort of material? I mean, people don't keep diaries anymore, do they?
Well, yes, some of us do.
Oh, do you? Yeah.
But what we don't have is film.
Mm.
And we'll have trouble because of that. Sometimes people aren't aware, but the change over from film to digital has led to a loss of photographic materials. So there's people who are working hard to preserve actual film and preserve the machines that will play that material, show it, and also photographers who are old-style photographers. I have one friend who uses a big plate camera. He has trouble getting the paper that's a high enough quality to actually print on.
Right.
Kodak has agreed finally to continue making paper, but they actually closed down their factories.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that the material we've got on digital, it doesn't have a long life. And so, you know, a person might take photographs, they might keep them on their camera, they might add them to their computer. But if you put material like that into an external hard drive, it's only got about 15 years. So there are people busy trying to transfer old-style videotape and stuff like that. If they don't, it's dust.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether we'll have the kind of material that we had in the past, but we may have a complete different kind.
Right.
Right. But it certainly has changed, and I'm conscious of that, and I'm conscious of having taken photographs all up the coast with an old Nikon with print film. And also digital, and I find looking at the old print film kind of interesting. That it's the differences in between the two is of interest.
Really,
but of course, August only working black and white, right? And there was another person up here doing documentary, where it's Francis Barrow, and he also shot some film, which I've dealt with as well, and that's been transferred to video because the film, of course, is getting pretty fragile.
Yeah.
But he was documenting rock art very, very early, all up and down the whole coast. Very interesting photographer.
You mentioned these appearances that you've made for the book so far, and you made one here recently in Vancouver, and then people coming out to the talk, some of these folks even knew the Chouinards. What's the reaction been to the book from family relations? Because there are quite a few nephews and others left. So what have they thought of the book?
Well, that varies. Glenn Macklin certainly has been appreciative, and I was pretty careful to try and get these people copies early so that they could have a look at them. It's interesting how people read them, that about their own family.
Yeah.
And I would say Norman Fair, who's one of Pansy's sons, has done the most thorough reading with complete regular emails documenting what he thinks.
Uh-huh. Right?
So certainly he's engaged very strongly with the story and how I've pulled it towards the end. Other people, I don't think they read. They read more sporadically. Some people just look at the pictures, right, and then read the captions, and then they maybe read that section or something. So it depends on the person. There is some, sometimes people are made to feel extremely uneasy.
Mm-hmm.
I try, if I can, to make clear to them what I've tried to do in relation to anything that refers to them. I've also been careful with material that I got from Darren Blaney, who's the Homalco chief, who was very helpful, and he came and spoke at the Campbell River book launch. He's been very generous, actually. And of course, he's referred to in the book as well. So all these people, you never quite know how it's going to go, you know?
Yeah.
And but so far, so good.
Yeah.
But people are very polite on the whole,
right.
And so they may not say everything that other people just treat it as a lark. Oh, here's this book about my family. Look at this. And some of these people are quite loosely related, or distantly related,
sure.
But they're interested nonetheless.
Yeah. Well, for someone who obviously isn't related to these folks or who knew of them before I started reading the book, they're just such a fascinating group of people, you've done a great service to capturing them for a wider audience, for the rest of us in British Columbia who should know them. I've kept you longer than I said I would. It's just been such a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on this book, Judith, and all good wishes with it. It's doing quite well in terms of sales, isn't it?
It is, and I appreciate that you read so carefully, which I can tell from your questions. So thank you very much.
The book is called Cougar Companions, Butte Inlet Country and the Legendary Chouinards, Rain Coast Chronicles 24 from Harbor Publishing. Its author, Judith Williams, joined me on the line from Cortes Island, British Columbia, in Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.